Cheers.
Salute. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Hi, everybody. This is Busted Business Bureau. I'm Christian Borky. If you like this podcast, please consider leaving a review. I can't even plug my social media anymore because I don't want to be online ever. And speaking of being offline, I have with me Jacob Reno.
Oh, my goodness. Hello.
Hi, Jacob. I'm so happy to finally have you on the podcast.
I'm so happy to be here. What are you talking about? This is an honor. Truly.
Do you want to grab the mic for a second and let the divas know what you're all about?
Sure. Yeah. I'll let the divas know. What's up, divas? My name is Jacob Ryan Reno. I'm a performance artist based here in the city of Chicago, Illinois. Recently behind Terrible Portraits here in Chicago, where I draw terrible portraits of people in 5 terrible minutes. Yes. It's been a blast to do. It's been so fun. I usually hang out like the Logan Square Farmers Market or also private events as well. So if you have a birthday party, funeral.
Have you done a funeral yet?
No, and I really am worried about stating what I have stated now because I did actually get reached out to for a funeral, and I'm like, I don't know if I can take the vibe.
You said no?
I was going dancing later that night, and I'm like, I don't think that I can like go to a funeral and then go to the club. Like, that feels like it's a little too short notice. I have to like be mentally prepared to do a funeral. But yeah, I'm a terrible portraitist. I have no intention of getting better. And also I do stand up on the side and whatever, and you know,
absolutely.
Yeah, strange to talk about yourself.
You know? Now, let me ask you this. You used to have some flavor of corporate job, and then for a long time you did not.
Yes.
Why did you leave?
Oh,
what
my God.
About that life didn't appeal to you?
Oh my God, I hated it. I couldn't stand it. It was just like I graduated college in 2020, and so I just was like, I'm like, this is what you're supposed to do is make it a 9-to-5. And so yeah, I did. And then I was like, oh my God, like this is like all kind of bad. And then I like intentionally quit to like go and live abroad for a stint of time, and then I came back to Chicago and got another corporate job.
Period.
Which I was like, I'm insane for doing this. I hate like the performative aspect of corporate jobs. Mm-hmm. Like I think there is like it is theater. I think corporatism is theater, and the fact that like people do take it so seriously and like believe that they are like actually making a difference when it is just like this slew of like back and forth.
What did you wear to work?
I would try to look stylish. I would try to be like, yeah, I'm like cool. All right, you know, like I would try to like look nice, you know, as nice as I like possibly could. Oh my God. I literally am just knocking over things on the table right now for the people listening at home. I'm just a mess. Yeah, I think I would look pretty stylish. I would do my best.
That wasn't a leading question. I just am confounded by men's fashion, and I don't know what you're supposed to wear or purchase or what is appropriate for particular situations. So I always like asking men about what they wear.
The thing that like got me being like, I need to quit this job is that they were like, I guess we like shared an office with like another company, which I did not know. Mm-hmm. And so I would always go over to like this other side of the office and I would like take snacks. I thought that it was like all connected. you know, and then I had like my AirPods in, you know, and I'm like walking back to the kitchen and I get stopped and it's just like this lady being like, hey, like look, like I don't care, but I'm just letting you know that like you're not supposed to like take those snacks. And I was like kind of scoffed. And I was like, okay, you know, like I was like, are you for real right now? Like, is this like really what you're going to like do? Like, I was like, this is insane. This is like, listen how arbitrary this is right now, you know?
That was your final straw.
That was
the snacks.
Kind of my final straw. I was like, I need to get the fuck out of here.
Absolutely.
Can we curse here? Is that okay?
What? Everyone ask me that on the podcast. Yes, of course you can curse.
Because Christian's going to get demonetized if we do.
I don't make – I make Patreon money.
Oh, yeah.
And do you think a single corporate sponsor would want to purchase ad space on Busted Business
Bureau?
That's
pretty good. Yeah, Lockheed Martin sponsored. We stand with BBB.
So speaking of which, now it's time for our first commercial break. Raytheon. So I'm excited to dig into our episode because it is about fake jobs.
Yeah.
It's about money that does and doesn't exist. Schrodinger's dollar, if you will.
Ooh, okay. I like it.
This is an episode about the Bayou Hedge Fund Group. it's going to be very fun. Do those words mean anything to you?
B-U-Y?
No, bayou, like down by the bayou in New Orleans.
Oh. Or I thought it was like also like bi, like the whole bisexual group of people. I'm like, hell yeah, support. they stand with me. Okay, bayou.
For
bayou.
Us and bayou.
Yeah. Okay. You could have been their marketing manager, really.
If they had just even one single bisexual on the team, I think this all could have been prevented.
All could have been avoided, you know?
So let's get on the same page here about what is a hedge fund. Okay. Because honest to God, those words don't mean anything to me.
No, those are made up. Yeah.
They don't evoke any images in my mind.
None of those words are in the Bible.
It's a private investment funding pool. Mm. So you and I could not necessarily participate in a hedge fund. We couldn't send them our money to make more money with,
okay,
because you and I are not high wealth individuals.
No, not at all.
We're not millionaires. We don't have an extra $3 million laying around for people to make more money off of.
No.
But that is the point of a hedge fund, is if you're either a super rich individual or you're like Harvard University's endowment, and you want to take money that people donate to Harvard and then make more money off of it,
okay,
you would send that money to a hedge fund. And the purpose of a hedge fund is it's folks who are really well versed in the stock market, who understand different tools for making more money, short selling, investing in certain companies.
Got it.
They know of a bunch of like financial tricks.
Okay.
So when you have a lot of money and you want it to make more money, you like put it through a hedge fund and say, here's $1 million. I want it to be $1,003,000 in, you know, 5 years or whatever.
Okay.
It is much quicker than that, though. You wouldn't make $3 in 5 years.
And people like work for hedge funds. Like a hedge fund is like a company, I guess.
Yes.
So, like you work for like of brokers and blah, blah, blah.
Traders.
Blah, blah. Like,
yes.
Okay.
Folks work at the hedge fund, right? Yeah. Who are, again, theoretically versed in the stock market. They know how to, you know, do a big short squeeze. They know how to do this or that.
Yeah. Okay.
So, again, supposed to be operated by people who fundamentally understand the stock market, serving individuals or you know, large investors. There's a word
of
for
ultra
it.
High wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Institutional investors. So it could be something like a group of pensions for the state of Illinois.
Okay.
You know, like gets put through this hedge fund to make it make more money so that way we can pay out the pensioners.
Got it. See, and then like you pool the money together. So it's like different money coming from a bunch of different angles and places.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All in like a one pool.
And hedge fund managers, again, are supposed to be in on a lot of stuff that maybe is not legal for them to know. But you know,
yeah,
they're like
it.
Inside the stock market. They understand like where businesses are trending. They have algorithms on their little computers that understand where the market is going to be headed. Whatever.
Hacks.
So obviously, hedge fund management is a rich man's game.
Yeah.
It's difficult to break into the industry.
Seems like it.
By your bootstraps.
Yeah.
So who are the types of rich men that get into this sort of thing? And that's going to be our main character today, Samuel Israel III.
Samuel Israel III.
Which...
That, yeah.
All you needed to say was his name
again. That's who we're rocking with right now?
That's who we're rocking with.
Okay. All right.
What do you picture someone like Samuel Israel III looks like?
I go immediately to like monocle, like Monopoly Man. Like, I don't know. Anytime I think of like money, I do think I'm like, that's old money. Like, I'm like this being like a man like being like, I'm going to buy the town, you know? Like, I think of like, you know, oil tycoon vibe.
And you nailed it. You can't be named Samuel Israel III in hedge fund management and not obviously come from money.
It's the third that really gets me.
It's really funny.
Like, yeah, low-key, like, be original.
Because
like,
his dad is definitely not going by Junior. His dad is, if anything, going by the second, but his dad mostly goes by Sam Israel.
Yeah, sure, I believe that. If the grandfather is dead, you know, then...
Now, the grandfather did make a bunch of money, I think, in New Orleans, but
really?
Samuel III grew up in New York.
Okay.
So I forget, honestly, where New Orleans comes into play of all this, other than Samuel Israel III went to Tulane University back in New Orleans.
Got it. And what year, when are we talking here?
So he was born in, so he was 18 years old in 1977. What does that make him born in? 1950 something?
Okay, but 18, so this is like the 70s going into the 80s, like just want to, okay.
Is when he's coming of age,
got
correct.
It.
So he grows up, obviously, in quite a lot of wealth, but is determined to beat the Nepo baby allegations, mind you.
Yeah.
He does not want to just go into his dad's company or his grandfather's company. He does want to make something of himself.
Okay.
So it's He's 18 years old. He's in his uncle's backyard bartending some party.
Cool. All right.
Yeah, kind of.
He's a man, you know.
I rock with that.
Blue collar, you know. Like, it's good to, yeah, just stay connected with the people.
Get to know people. Your an 18-year-old bartender is very funny, though.
Yeah, that's like truly like a kid, like, in a suit, you know. Like,
he's pouring crazy shit back there.
Yeah, oh, for sure. Probably not knowing what he's doing.
Has no idea what, like, a shot. He has no idea what an ounce and a half is, you know.
Yeah,
like,
no, just being like, what do you want?
Yeah, I'll pour it in a glass, and if you wince, I will pour something different in a glass. So he's bartending his uncle's party in the backyard. 1977. Okay. He's 18 years old. There's a man at the party named Freddie Graber.
Freddie Graber. Heard.
He's the kind of rich, gregarious man you'd see in a gangster movie in the 20s.
Like,
to me,
cool.
I'm picturing, like, KFC white suit, big mustache, like, big hat.
I like it, yeah. Doug Dimmadome hat.
Doug Dimmadome vibes,
okay.
For real.
Cool.
However, an energy that gives, I've been to a Walmart before.
Oh, okay, okay.
So not completely out of touch with normal men, but, like, the poor person's idea of a rich person.
Yeah, someone who likes to be like, actually, I'm quite in touch.
You know? He's the kind of guy who, when you go to a fancy restaurant to get caviar, and this is a real story from the book that I will tell you more about, instead of, like, eating caviar from little pieces of toast that they give you, he'll take it by the spoonful and just hawk it back of his throat. It's excessive. It's obscene.
The performance of wealth.
The performance of wealth.
Okay.
No, exactly.
Interesting.
So, Graybar approaches the bar, operated by the teenage Sam Israel.
By this kid in a suit, yeah.
In his uncle's backyard. And I'm going to read you how the book of this episode phrases it. Quote, he was also, Freddie Graybar was a serious drinker. Graybar asked the young Israel for a vodka and cranberry juice on the rocks with a chunk of lime. Israel handed over the drink and introduced himself, knowing his last name would be recognized. Graybar was polite, but didn't take much notice of the eager teenager. When Graybar returned for another drink a few minutes later, Sam was ready. Vodka and cranberry on the rocks, Sam said, mixing the cocktail before Graber could even order, with a chunk of lime. You have a good memory, kid, Graber said. You any good with numbers?
Well, first of all, I think that's written quite strangely.
Say it. No, say it.
That's written poorly. that's a vodka cranberry on the rocks with a lime. Vodka cran.
Vodka cran. Right, it's already rocks.
Yeah,
you don't do that neat.
As both of us who have worked as bartenders too.
I'm glad you immediately picked up on it because that was the first thing like
it popped up to for your head too.
Yes, because I went, okay, the book is called Octopus, Sam Israel, The Shadow Market, and Wall Street's Wildest Con. And it's written by a guy named Guy Lawson.
Love a guy.
Who gets exclusive interviews with Sam Israel, a couple other key characters as we go along, and was definitely there's prison that's going to be involved in this.
Okay.
He was there at the sentencing, the author of this book.
Oh, really? Okay.
So he's been with the Sam Israel story for a while.
Okay. Content warning, prison.
However, it becomes clear halfway through the book especially that he takes Sam Israel for a lot of his word.
Okay.
And will then print it without thinking about it.
Sure.
Such as the phrase vodka and cranberry juice on the rocks. It would take an ounce of due diligence to know that it's a vodka cran. It's a vodka cranberry.
Yeah.
It just, like, saying on the rocks does not make any sense. Not even in 1977.
No, definitely not. And wait, what year did this book come out? I feel like I'm quizzing you.
2012.
Okay, got it. Okay, I'm just trying to.
I'm supposed to know these things.
Okay, all right, that's fair. Okay, yeah, I'm curious. So he just goes, what, are you good with numbers, kid? Like, a deus ex machina, you know?
So then, of course, this is how Sam Israel breaks into the world of Wall Street and finance, because Freddie Graber is some sort of high-level trader, and this is before computers.
Yeah.
So he has the kind of mind that can keep track of a lot of information at once. His strategy is executing a lot of really little trades that would make you like a couple cents.
Okay.
But doing like a bunch of those.
Like penny stock kind of stuff.
Yes.
Okay.
That's his vibe, which, when that predates computers, that is a big toll on the mind. You have to be a big personality to be able to like handle all of that stuff.
Damn, yeah.
So that is how Sam Israel starts cutting his teeth, is coming up under this guy's wing. Of course, he goes through a lot of hazing.
Sure.
And he learns the way of Wall Street by way of Doug Dimmadome,
okay,
owner of
beautiful.
The Dimmsdale Dimmadome.
I will only be referring to him as such from now on. No, I'm kidding.
I really need to circle back to this vodka cranberry on the rocks.
Vodka
cranberry juice on the rocks.
Dude, so yeah, I'm like, why use seven words when you can use three? Or, you know, it's
right.
Just like that is the classic. I'm just more coming at it from a literary standpoint. that is where I stand on this.
So per Israel's own account, here's kind of what it was like to trade stock back in the day. When you don't have computers, when you only rely on the information of others, those sort of back bar meetings become crucial in your job. Mm. His job, as he describes it, is getting I'll read you the quote. And this is from Sam Israel III himself.
Oh, okay, okay. The direct quote. Okay.
And it does not matter who Jake is, for reference.
Okay, heard.
Okay. Jake held court at a bar called Michael's 2. He sat far at the far left end of the bar. The place would be packed with Wall Streeters watching basketball. It didn't look like it, but Jake's circle was exclusive. That's how things worked. The lines and boundaries were invisible. The guys at the left end of the bar looked like a few guys unwinding after work. Jake didn't look rich. He didn't act rich. He sat there getting drunk, which became one of my jobs, getting drunk with Jake. The first time I went with Freddie, Graybar, Doug Dimmadone.
Got it.
I kept quiet and I just watched. Jake wouldn't come out directly and say things, but he would give you enough circumstantial hints that you could figure out, like Shell Oil getting bought in 1984. Then the airlines happened. Jake knew every one of these deals. Hmm. Jake was doing the analysis, or he knew the guy that knew the guy. It was an incestuous world. That's how people put things together. Jake was just one piece of the puzzle.
Fascinating. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just always, you know, especially with like working with money in this regard, just how everything kind of like comes together, how it does. It is just people at the end of the day. It is such a human game, even though like people are so objective about like crunching numbers. And at the end of the day, it's just a couple
it's
of
Jake.
Like dudes in suits, you know? Yeah, just like making decisions.
And this is the example I feel like I've given a lot on the podcast of understanding how insider trading works. It's like, if you are out here trading stocks and you need to think which company is going to do well in the next few weeks, and you have a friend who works at Apple who says, we're launching an iPhone next week. Right. Like the first ever iPhone, you would know to buy a bunch of Apple stock because it's probably going to jump up a bunch when they announce the iPhone.
Of course.
That is just how things in Sam Israel III's world worked back in the 70s and 80s when he's cutting his teeth in this like high-flying Wall Street trading world.
Yeah, it's like state representatives also, you know, investing in stock.
Like, your job is getting drunk with Jake.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Just being like, hey, what's going on in the market, my guy, you know? Okay.
So that's classic Wild West pre-computer nonsense. And nowadays, it's kind of hard to remember those days because now all the dorks are building algorithms and predictively, you know, analyzing the stock market with their numbers and computers.
Yeah, all AI.
Yeah. But that's how, again, Sam Israel cuts his teeth. There's another example. I guess I'll just tell you the example from the book. The Kansas Southern Railroad story is one to understand how things could go wrong.
Okay.
Sam's insider information tells him that the Kansas Southern Railroad Company is selling, but they're going to be purchased by a member of the board. So, like, it's just sort of going to change hands, but it's going to be a guy who's well familiar with the company, which would be a good move. And if that is a good move, a bunch of people would want to invest in it. So you should buy some stock right now because they're about to sell the company to someone who's going to do amazing at it. That's, like, the insider information.
Interesting. Okay.
Sam then goes and he buys a bunch of stock in the company.
Yeah.
And then they delay the announcement of who the new CEO is going to be. Then they keep delaying the announcement only to announce it's going to be, like, some schmuck they're selling for parts, like, the sale that Sam thought it was going to be was not what they announced at all. So then the stock plummets and he loses $400,000.
Which back then is like $1 billion. Like, that's an obscene amount of money.
Obscene.
Or whatever. Yeah.
In any regard.
I mean, even now. Yeah. I'm like, that's a lot of money.
And that's the kind of money that he was dealing with under Freddie Graybar. Or Graybar, or whatever his name is.
Taking him under the wing because he has a good memory.
It's real money based around hype, which is fake, but it is rooted in some kind of reality because the sale of this Kansas Southern Railroad Company didn't go well.
Okay.
Like, things are both real and fake.
Yeah, it's true. Wow. Much to ponder. Much to sit upon with this.
So much to ponder.
So much to think about.
And I didn't write this in the script anywhere, but at some point I just need to mention that he has a wife and children. Sam Israel III.
Okay, got
has
it.
Has a wife and children.
As all this is going on.
High school sweetheart.
Really? Classic.
Who, when he went to college at Tulane University, he got really into drugs. He didn't even finish at Tulane University. He started working for Freddie Graybar, like, quite early.
He's 18, yeah.
And his job was to go out and get drunk with Jake and do drugs and go to brothels, which, of course, he doesn't really explain any of that to his wife because he keeps it hidden from her.
Sure. He's just at work.
What is also relevant is at one point he's building a play set for his daughter, like, in their front yard or something, like, you know, moving wood and a slide and monkey bars or something. And he's got something that's like 100 pounds in his hand. Someone comes to the door and he turns his head and he fucks up his back for like what will be the rest of his life.
Really?
Yes.
Ah, geez.
a simple thing that I need to plant now, which I didn't have in the script, but I remembered about it. I knew I need to say it.
That just made me stand up straight or like sit up straight.
You know? You ever have a back injury?
Oh, yeah. I'm like, I'm a big sloucher, you know?
Really?
So I'm just like, yeah. Anytime I hear about anybody throwing their back out, I'm like, nothing will ever be the same if anything ever happened to me.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Even sore from one day at the gym, it's devastating.
Yeah, you're done, you know? Okay. So, well, wow. Is he going to like be a hunchback or like what's going to happen? Like, What's going to happen?
The Hunchback of Wall Street coming at you.
What's going to happen to him? What's going to happen?
So, computers are coming out, and people are now starting to execute. Freddie Graybar is like bread and butter, right? Is all those little trades.
Yeah.
People can do that much more easily when you have computers handling it for you.
Okay.
You don't need to physically approach someone, etc.
Yeah, for penny stock or anything like that. Okay.
And Freddie Graybar is just not interested in learning about computers at all. So Sam Israel is. He learns a bunch of... Again, this was described in the book, and I just didn't care because it was kind of malarkey.
Sure.
The thing... But the basic kernel of truth there is that he was learning how to be adept at computers, did learn more than Freddie Graybar knew.
Okay. That's like studio execs being like, sound in pictures. Like, you know, like...
It'll never work.
No way. Yeah.
That is the most accurate description. I always used to think as a kid, like, all new technology is good technology.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really until, like, quite recently where I was like, no, it's actually not.
Yeah, I'm like, I go back and forth where I'm like, yeah, like, it's great for, like, you know, medical advancement, mm-hmm. but yeah, with, like...
Now I really do understand the studio executives who are like, sound will never work in the pictures.
Yeah, I'm like that would have been me, you know, that would have been like, mm-hmm. probably. Well, I don't know. Yeah, who knows? It depends on the idea. It depends on the idea.
It does depend on the idea, but I'm like, where the computer will do all of the thinking and art for you. Like, I don't want that.
Terrible.
Yeah, that stinks. That's so boring.
I'm so anti-AI, not to get on a train.
Or Google Glass. Remember that?
Oh, my God. So stupid. Oculus Rift. Scary.
Stupid.
Scary.
Didn't like it.
No. Boo.
Yes, I guess we are Hollywood executives in the business.
Yeah. Say, baby. You know, yeah.
Your social life will never be online.
We just need a cigar in here, honestly, is what we need.
Oh, my God. I do need to start smoking on the podcast.
That'd be hilarious. Yeah. Just like... You know.
So, computers plus a big stock market crash of 1987 that I don't care to understand sort of drives Graybar out of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And Sam spent the better part of a decade learning under Freddie Graybar and developing his personality around that, which is at this point, I need to say, Sam Israel III is not like other girls.
Okay, wow.
You know the meme?
Oh, yeah, of course I do.
To explain the meme, if there aren't listeners that are our exact age, which I feel like we came up when it was not ironic and then quickly when it became ironic, you know.
I'm not like other girls.
It was sort of a Tumblr thing in 2010 where if you were not conventionally attractive into cheerleading and makeup, that made you not like other girls. And so it was then a point of pride for, you know, some girls to alienate those girls and say, I like eating pizza and I like My Chemical Romance and, you know.
That was a great way to describe it, I will say. That was like a very, very good, like, I don't know. If someone asked me to describe like what it's not like other girls like, I'd just be like, you know, you're just not like other girls. Like, I don't know.
But it really is pizza very, very and My Chemical Romance makes you not like other girls.
Touch My Butt, Buy Me Pizza.
Exactly.
Remember that?
I do remember that.
Yeah.
But then quickly, because so many people identified with this not like other girls meme, it becomes clear that everybody is like those girls. Because everybody likes pizza and My Chemical Romance.
Of course.
And, you know...
Being
the outsider. So it's a point of comedy then to say something is not like other girls because it's like you think you're being a contrarian when you're in fact fitting to this, you know, you're conforming to this standard. Yeah. So in so many ways, Sam Israel III is not like other girls in that he's not a stuffy Wall Street business type, but the person that he is exactly like so many other people on Wall Street.
He's
where it's like
a cool guy.
I don't wear suits.
Yeah.
I have SpongeBob SquarePants on all my personal checks.
Yeah, okay.
That is a fact.
Wait, really?
I'm not making that up.
That's actually hilarious.
I leave meetings to go smoke a joint.
Okay. So like a tech kind of bro.
Exactly.
Kind of vibe.
But you know exactly who that is because there's a million not like other girls out there.
You know, in the world. I'm going to think about that the rest of the podcast, actually. SpongeBob SquarePants on all of his personal checks. Hilarious.
SpongeBob SquarePants comes up like five times in this book.
That's so funny.
But he would have come up when it was like 1998 to 2005. Yeah, SpongeBob SquarePants,
like,
which actually
was not like so he would have been like what, like around like at least 45, mm-hmm. like when he
But honestly, like that early SpongeBob was peak, so like I get
it. True, based hit. I don't have checks, but I honestly should just to do that. That's hilarious. Thanks, Sam Israel III, for the idea. If you're listening from prison, maybe I don't know.
So. At this point, yeah, Sam Israel's not like other girls. He develops a lot of Frederick Graber's personality, and he has a little tattoo on his hip of a smiling cherub that's the little devil, because he is not like other girls.
Oh, my God. Give me a break.
I'm going to read more from the book. Quote, Sam developed an alter ego he called Captain Proton, a fearless superhero whose special powers were infused by vodka and cocaine. When Sam inhabited the character, he would turn an umbrella into a sword and a curtain into his cape as he set about crusading through the bars and clubs of Manhattan. We were hedge fund heroes, Israel recalled.
That's so embarrassing.
It's so cringe.
I'm like, I just do that on a regular Friday night, you know? Like, that's...
As Freddy's protege, I was in the thick of it. Everyone called me the kid. I was out of my mind having fun. I would get shit-faced and do outrageous things. I didn't give a fuck. I would get my ear pierced on a dare. I would pull a tablecloth from a table filled with plates and glasses like I was a magician. Only everything would go flying.
Whoa, dude. What? This guy's crazy.
He's not like other Wall Street traders.
Like he's not like other rich kids, you know?
So, 1996, right? I know this is kind of a time jump or whatever, but by 1996, he decides to found his own hedge fund company.
Okay.
Because he has enough experience in the industry, he has enough money, and he has enough cred in the community.
So he just gallivanted around for this amount of time, just working for Mr.
Doing
Duncan
Wall Street, doing whatever he does. And so, like I said, he's got enough trading experience and personal wealth that he could start something like a hedge fund. I'm going to read from the book. I guess I'll get there. It has an unusual structure, Bayou Hedge Fund, because at this point, at least according to Israel, there aren't like a bunch of hedge funds out there. We have not hit the 2008 financial crash yet, so people are not suspicious of hedge funds. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So kind of the Wild West of the hedge fund world. He breaks up the company into two separate entities, which is Bayou Securities and Bayou Funds.
Interesting.
It's not important that you know what those two things do. It's just important to know there's two different companies that are operating under the same umbrella. Mm-hmm. So I'll read you from the book. Quote, as conceived by Israel, Bayou had an unusual structure based on how Freddie Graber ran his fund. Two separate entities, Bayou Securities, Bayou Funds. Instead of using outside brokers for its trade, like most hedge funds, Bayou Securities would be an independent in-house broker-dealer. By keeping the brokerage business to himself, Israel would capture revenues from the commissions from his own trades. He would also get commissions for making trades with other funds. The structure gave the hedge fund a competitive advantage. Sam's idea enabled Bayou to offer a discount to investors. Bayou Securities would generate more than enough income to enable Bayou Funds to not have to charge the regular 2% to defray its administrative costs.
That, like, quote, I feel like just made the steam come out of my ears, as in that is my brain working so hard to be like, what? Are they doing?
Here's the thing. It kind of doesn't matter if you understand what's going on.
They're just making a lot of money.
Doing something a little different from the industry. It's 1996. Who cares? But also, it is not your job. I will take a break to turn to the camera and say, not your job to understand. There is no camera in here.
Okay. Oh, my God. I'm like, yeah, no, truly. I'm like...
It's not your job to understand anything that's going on, baby girl.
It's great. And honestly, I'm here for the vibe. I am here for the goddamn ride.
This is mostly for listeners that aren't getting drunk along with us that might actually care about the details.
Let me paint a picture. It's me and Christian Borky, and I have a tequila soda in my hand. And Christian, what are you doing, a whiskey soda? Yeah, mm-hmm. Hell yeah.
And yours is now empty.
Yes,
so
it is.
I'm taking intermission.
And Christian pours them heavy.
Yeah. So... now, our key player is the ringmaster, Sam Israel, but now it's time to introduce some new characters into the fray.
Let's do it.
So, first of all, we got Jimmy Marquez. Long story short, honestly, Guy Larson writes the greatest sentence I've ever heard about Jimmy Marquez. Okay, quote, with a little gentle resume editing, with some elisions and ambiguous wording and tactical amnesia, Marquez's trading record could still be made to look sterling to investors who don't know the truth.
Oh.
Devastating.
That's a real dig.
That's gaggy. Marquez's entire job throughout the book is just that he stinks at training. But
okay.
He's willing to go into business with Sam Israel, and he makes a bunch of bad decisions. That's Jimmy Marquez. Now, the main guy, the name you will need to remember is Dan Marino. As a child, he had mumps.
Dan Marino?
Yeah.
Isn't that like a name of like a football coach?
Or I don't know.
That's like a famous name.
Probably not him.
Viewers at home, please tell him, please call into the studio. We will still be here when this airs.
Did football coach Dan Marino have mumps as a child?
I don't know. That name just sounds really, really familiar. Dan Marino.
Well, yeah. I guess I have a computer. Oh, yeah, football quarterback.
Oh, my God. Okay, a quarterback. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
With the Miami Dolphins.
Got it. He's famous for some reason. I don't know why.
It's not giving any sort of, you know, he's not like OJ famous.
No, definitely not. No one can reach his level of fame.
Yeah, but you were right. He is a, okay. Look at you, sports.
Thank, oh yeah, I guess. Wow, oh my God. My father would be so proud of me. Dad, if you're listening at home, please call into the studio. And
and tell Jacob that you love him.
Yeah.
Please. Please, Mark. So, Dan Marino, he is not a giant football quarterback. Instead, he's a scrawny little man, partially deaf from the mumps as a child, and he's awkward. He's the main accountant for this operation. Bayou Hedge Fund starts off in Sam Israel's basement, and Sam Israel's not explaining anything that's going on to his wife. Which is very funny because it's going to get crazy quite quickly.
No, yeah, baby, it's don't worry, kitten.
don't worry about a kitten.
Yeah, the walls are closing in on daddy. You seen that? Yeah.
I've seen a House MD meme where he's like, I'll be honest, ducklings, I'm going to kill myself.
That's very good.
So it's Sam Israel's basement. It's those three guys on the phone, printing stuff, faxing stuff probably, doing copious amounts of coke all day, I can only imagine. Marquez gets it in his head that investors wouldn't take them seriously if they saw the, you know, decrepit state of their company.
Okay.
Because they are, for what it's worth, decent at trading in the beginning.
Yeah.
It's not like they're amazing, they're not doing spectacular, but they're not immediately losing money.
Sure.
So Marquez gets it in his head, if we had to take a meeting with investors and they came and they saw your dumb basement with your dumb children's toys all around because your kids live here, they would not take us seriously. So let's spend a bunch of money and get like a beach house type thing, like this ritzy, glamorous, floor-to-ceiling glass
boys trip
office, and let's buy this office or like rent it out or whatever for an exorbitant amount of money and take all of our meetings there.
Oh my God.
Which is sort of a negative feedback loop, right? It's an arms race in seeming like you have your shit together.
Yeah, vacation forever.
So people make the assumption that you have your shit together by the fact that you have this nice office, so then they invest their money in your company, but then you have to actually execute on their and the promise to like make them more money, which you don't have because you spent their money on the rent for that building. So it's like a negative feedback loop of seeming like you have your shit together without having your shit together.
All show and no work. It's a front. Yeah, it's a total front of like, yeah, we do have our shit together. Interesting.
So, and like I said, they actually do have trading experience. They aren't terrible at it in the first year, but they're not great. 1996 rolls to 1997. There's a big Asian stock market crash that, again, I also don't understand. But 1997 Asian financial crash, I just know for some reason.
Heard.
But it's not a great year for the stock market, I'll say that much. And they realize by 1998, they will never pass a serious financial audit.
Okay.
So Dan Marino comes up with an idea.
He pulls in the boys from the
from the Dolphins.
Yeah, exactly. He goes, boys. Yeah.
We're breaking some knees over at the SEC. So he has the idea to make up his own auditing firm and to independently audit Bayou Hedge Fund. Dan Marino founds the Richmond Fairfield accounting firm.
Get out of town.
And literally gets office space. I'll read the quote from Dan Marino himself in the book. The interesting part, to me at least, was how easy it was to... Sorry, I'm laughing into the quote. Okay, Dan Marino again. The interesting part, to me at least, was how easy it would have been to put my name together with this auditor. All you had to do is Google Richmond Fairfield, and my name would come up. The fake firm was registered with the New York State Accounting Society. If anyone had even gone to the office I subletted, they would have seen my name in the directory. Any minor but persistent due diligence would have discovered my link to Richmond Fairfield immediately. Why no one did it is simply beyond me to explain.
Dog.
I would have done it.
I feel that. Yeah, of course. It just takes one step of research to get anything done, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah.
And so, starting in 1998, in order to pass audits or whatever, like that regulators demand of these hedge funds, they send all of their accounts to Richmond Fairfield to audit to make sure they're passing all this federal regulation bullshit. But it's just Dan Marino sitting there, like, fudging the numbers.
That's insane.
And also, claiming to pass the audit.
The fact that it's so easy to make a company like this and being like, oh, well, I'll just make an audit.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that it, I explained to you in detail that you don't care about, but it doesn't matter. The fact that it is technically two separate companies makes it easier for Dan Marino to fudge the numbers.
Oh, sure. Of course, you know.
Especially if you don't look at his audits with an eye for detail, which nobody did.
Okay.
This is another Dan Marino banger of a quote. Quote, if the investors were smart enough to truly look at the financial statement of Bayou Funds, they would have asked me for an explanation. No one asked. If they did ask, I would have said we had two accounts with the clearinghouse because we didn't want them to know all the trades we do. Mm. The regulators could have looked at the audit and asked for the statements when they were looking at Bayou Securities. The regulators should have known that when they inspected Bayou Securities, they were actually seeing all the trading transactions of the hedge fund. They could have looked through the broker-dealer to see how the fund was doing and see that it was losing money. You could say it was elementary, or you could say it was sophisticated. The bottom line is, it worked. No one looked, ever.
Perfect. I'm not that I'm like rooting for them, but I'm like, God, you know, like it gets like really, you know, they're getting far with this, it seems, so.
It's, maybe it's the 90s.
Oh, you can do anything in the 90s. Yeah, because there was like also like no computer. There, yeah, like the technology was just like so limited and elementary, mm-hmm. that like you really could kind of get away with things like this.
I guess, you know, it reveals Dan Marino's, I guess, tactical amnesia, you might say, because you couldn't just Google things in the 90s.
No.
It does take basic due diligence that I feel like people did have in the 90s, but like it isn't just a Google search away.
No, that's true.
It does take a little bit more
think
effort.
Think about that. Yeah, like mm-hmm. you just gotta like, yeah, do a little bit more digging, you mm-hmm. know? A little
so
bit more friction.
They're making enough money. I mean, I guess they are not making money. They are losing money. They're not doing well. But it's not like billions of dollars worth of fraud mm-hmm. level scamming. It's just like they're sort of making the audits look like they're making money when they are not.
Okay.
And investors keep investing because they think the company is successful. So they're not losing any money at this point. Or not, it's not like somebody invested $1 million, expected to get, you know, $1.5 million back.
Yeah.
And then tried to take it out and didn't get it.
Okay.
That hasn't happened
yet. So
they're
still like, you know, returning, like what they're keeping mm-hmm. the promises to these people mm-hmm. still, even though it is in the background a little bit of a mess from what mm-hmm. we know.
In reality, by September of 2001, they were $12 million in the hole.
Oh my
According
God.
To investors, they were a $70 million fund. But they simply were not.
And, you know, terrible time for the U.S.
Guess what happened?
2001. Yeah.
The market tanks after 9/11. And Marquez is like, okay, we've been pulling this scam for like, you know, 4 or 5 years now.
Huh.
It's our time to get out.
Okay.
We can just get out. And this is not ending in 2001. I will tell you that much.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. It does not sound like it.
So post 9/11, again, the market tanks. They're absolutely fucked. Like they lose a bunch. Everyone loses a bunch of money.
Yeah.
And this is when Bayou properly becomes an actual Ponzi scheme.
Really?
Now, I will pause to explain. I know you know what a Ponzi scheme is, but I have an episode on Charles Ponzi himself on my podcast.
The Charles Ponzi.
Male Pisces. Lover boy. Hot.
Sexy.
Italian immigrant.
Really?
Yeah. Yes.
Si.
Charles,
que
like,
bellona.
It's one of the few episodes that I actually remember most of the details of because I, like, love Charles Ponzi. Like, there needs to be an Italian Lin-Manuel Miranda who makes a musical about Charles Ponzi.
Oh,
like, he's
God.
That interesting.
It's going to be me.
It's going to be you. I'm begging you.
To make it, yeah, Broadway, baby, let me tell you.
His
yeah.
wife is the same height as him, and they're both 5'4".
Hot.
Anyways, he's a short king who did nothing wrong. But a Ponzi scheme, people used to call it robbing Peter to pay Paul, right? You have new investors who believe in your company, mm-hmm. and when old investors want to cash out, you just use that new money that people gave you to pay those old investors out.
So you're not really making any money. Well, yeah, I mean, yeah. you're probably taking some cuts potentially, but okay.
Most Ponzi scheme, Charles Ponzi himself, the scheme that he cooked up is something about if you buy a bunch of stamps in Italy, then you redeem them in the United States and trade them out for U.S. stamps, like the currency exchange is different.
Oh, so that was like, that's the original Ponzi scheme?
Mm-hmm. And he thought that would work and it simply didn't. Like okay. he knew from day one, the second he tried it, it just didn't work.
Yeah, okay.
But he had already hyped up the company, and he was already like, if you invest $100 with me, you'll get $150 by the end of May.
Wow.
That sort of thing. So then everyone was hyped about it, yeah. and he was such a cool guy and likable that
sure.
everyone just invested money in his company. He realizes quickly that the actual business part of his plan is not going to work, but if someone comes to redeem that $150, you did just get $150 today from someone else investing in the company.
That is true.
You just pay them out with that.
Oh, man, that is true.
So that's you know, the origin of the word Ponzi scheme.
An endless cycle of, you know, just money coming and money going.
And the difference between Bayou Hedge Fund and most Ponzi schemes is, like, Bayou actually did attempt to do the business part, and for a while they were doing
it
the business part.
It sounds like it, yeah.
But, again, post 9/11, it's just straightforwardly a Ponzi scheme now.
Okay.
They really... they are still executing trades. They still hire traders who have no idea that they're working for, like, a Ponzi scheme. So they're keeping up the theater of the situation, but it's straight, like, again, post 9/11, it's just straightforwardly a Ponzi scheme.
Awesome. Rocking with it. Yeah.
What also kind of happens with a lot of Ponzi schemes, not all of them, but a lot, is they're started by people like Charles Ponzi himself, who grew up poor and are trying to learn the ways of the rich and learning how to charm the rich. But Sam Israel has always been rich. He knows how they work.
Yeah, this is also something that I feel like that we haven't touched on. He doesn't need to be doing all this. He doesn't need to be doing all this. He could probably just, you know, live a very comfortable and happy life, vibing out. And, you know, like, this is all play. This is all play for him. Like, it's not really about the money. This is all just, like, you know.
I'm going to read you a Sam Israel quote himself. I would create the perception that something... Perception was 9/10 of reality for the company. And I was one little guy doing that. It felt great. I wasn't some broker parroting other people, but there was a horrible downside. I created nothing, only money. I couldn't show my son a building I'd created. It was an illusion.
Ugh. See?
Yeah.
Nothing is real. None of this is real. It's all, yeah, none of this is real.
At this point, he hurts his back, or he throws out his back around, I think, 2001.
It sucks building something for your son, too. I don't know. There's something kind of, like, poetic in that.
And in the process of him having to go through multiple back surgeries.
Oh, it's, like, that bad?
It's that serious,
jeez.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
He gets addicted to prescription painkillers.
No.
While also being addicted to coke, while also being addicted to booze, right? Like, he's just doing all of the drugs all at once.
Oh, my God.
Becomes... coked out enough. Ugh, the most devastating story from the book that I'm just recalling from memory.
Yeah.
One time his wife and kids came home, and as a joke, he thought it'd be funny to greet them at the door wearing nothing but ladies' underwear and cowboy boots and, like, a lacrosse helmet.
Terrible.
Terrible. Not a funny joke.
No, not funny. First of all, I think that's the biggest beef with it. It's not funny. That's
it's not funny.
Yeah.
And I've known a guy like that before who, like, kind of...
Like, wouldn't it be funny if, like...
Yeah, and kind of would do stunts like that to his own wife and kids. Mm. And it's like, no, that's cringe and creepy.
Yeah, and that you're exposing your children.
It's not
that,
funny. Like,
know?
It's not about the ladies' underwear. It's not about the cowboy boots. It's about the fact that you thought this would be funny. And it's like, I can tell you're unwell by the fact that you thought this would be funny.
Ugh, yeah.
That's the thing that really, like...
That's major.
That's
yeah.
the 4D chess in my head.
Okay, well, if one of us ever does that, we'll say, hey...
I'll, like, hold your hand and
yeah,
say...
Yeah, please, and go, I love you, but, you know...
it's time to quit.
Yeah, that's not funny. Yeah.
After one of your stand-up shows, I'm like, listen.
Look. That's going to be me in my next stand-up show. It's just cowboy boots, ladies that are lingerie. So, what's the deal? No, that's my whole bit, actually, yeah.
So this warrants a divorce in 2003. There's going to be a lot of divorcing happening and a lot of, like, recoupling, then divorcing again, recoupling, divorcing again.
As rich people do. They love getting married.
But the main problem with the divorce is Sam was still running a lot of stuff from Bayou out of his basement, so now he needs to find somewhere to go.
Mm.
And you know what? Like, you got to convince investors that you're succeeding.
A legitimate company, yeah.
So I'm going to read you the quote from the book because it's a crazy-ass twist. Winding up the driveway of 52 Oregon Road in Mount Kisco, Sam knew he'd found the spot. The house wasn't so much a mansion as a monument to excess. The owner was Donald Trump.
No, you're joking. God damn it.
And this book predates Trump's even campaign,
like, yeah.
The first
time. Wow. Just him as, like, a mogul. Like,
Trump, everything around the house was comically over the top. So impossibly huge for one person to live in that it signified only massive insecurity. Set on a hill overlooking acres of woodlands, the grounds consisted of an apple orchard on one side and a meadow on the other. In front of the house was a courtyard with a large stone peeing boy fountain. The 8,000-square-foot Tudor-style manor had been built in 1913 for the Hines family. Donald Trump now rented it out for $22,000 a month.
$22,000 a month. Again, back then, insane amount of money. Again, still today, an insane amount of money.
Like,
the
what?
Boy peeing, too, very symbolic. Because this
know.
Is just, like, a pissing contest, like, at this point.
Period.
Yeah.
You better work.
It is. That's all money is. That's all business is. It's a pissing contest.
It,
like, it's
literally
just like
is.
A, yeah.
So... Oh, my God. I read that and a chill ran down my spine.
Wow. $22,000 a month. Okay, fuck that.
And, okay, here's actually the real kicker that I was devastated reading in the book. Part of why this Ponzi scheme stays successful for so long is because, you know, the key part, you can chew the ice on Mike. I don't care.
I'm chewing ice.
So, as you know, the Ponzi scheme is paying out old investors with new money. The thing about this hedge fund, though, is it's all rich people participating and sending their money in the hedge fund. They don't even take it out. So they
Why?
Had only withdrawn $11 million from the fund up until this point. Like, they just don't even need that money, that $3 million that you sent to the hedge fund. It's not like you need it in a year. So between 1996 and 2003, they'd only, like, people had only withdrawn $11 million.
Okay.
So even though this fund was, like, hemorrhaging money,
yeah,
they still had that $11 million at some point just to send to the people who are trying to redeem their money back. You know what I mean?
So I can't.
So that's how they can stay in the hole for so long, is nobody's asking for their money back.
In, yeah.
Right, nobody's cashing in.
Okay.
Isn't that, that's the most mind-boggling part to me of, like, how much money is at stake here and how much nobody needs this money.
No one cares about it. Yeah, yeah. Nobody is asking for it. I think, you know, when I think of, like, $1 million, I'm like, I cannot even imagine in my head what it would be to have $1 million in my bank account. Like, that is, there's no need. There's simply no need for that.
I'm also going to, you know, counter with this, too. You have this high-flying life. You got drugs. You got booze. You got this.
You got it all already.
I was going to say, I don't make $1 million a year, no. But I do drugs and have sex all the time.
Yeah, and it's a great—
And I love my life.
I'm so fine.
It's not like that's an inaccessible life to me. Like, drugs and sex are for everybody.
Yeah, and also, like, really nice dinner, you know? And I pay my rent, you know?
Exactly.
Like, I'm like, everything is fine. Yeah, I do excess. People living in excess.
Uh-huh. I work at a nonprofit, and I, you know, like, I still went to London once.
Yeah, and it's still a great time,
and
you know?
To me, that's more special because I can't afford to go to London all the time.
Like, on a dime, you know, on a whim.
Yeah. I had to save up a lot of money, think about the trip, take 2 weeks off, you know, like, it was a whole thing.
So much more rewarding.
It made it so much more rewarding of, like...
To work for some... What is it? People don't know how to work anymore. No, I'm kidding. Oh, my God, yeah. No,
yeah,
that's
like,
my...
Obviously, I mean, I know that I am wealthier than, like, quite a big percentage of the world.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I see these rich people lifestyles. I'm like, what is it that you guys are actually getting out of this? There's no material pleasure that you can get beyond, you know, maybe making $100,000 a year.
And it's like, look, we're all going to die. You know,
yeah.
I'm like, there's no this hoarding, you know. It's so egotistical. I think, like, that's the thing about it.
It's some sort of, like, it has to be a human mental, like,
illness,
yeah, of, like, needing to hoard, because we all are morally average primates trying to survive all the time.
Yeah.
So I can see why you would be hoarding like that.
Yeah, gathering a behavior.
And how that generational wealth could impact your brain into thinking, like, I need to be hoarding more and more and more and more.
Mm.
So the thing
is, it is very, very interesting to, like, dissect the philosophy of money and, like, why people, like, want this so bad, you know?
Yeah, because you're really not living much more comfortably than someone who makes a good salary
exactly. That,
like, spends their money appropriately. You know what
yeah.
I mean? Like, what else are you getting out of this?
Nothing.
And the thing about being a chronically in pain addict is that you're very likely to fall into losing touch with reality.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Yeah.
So
again, perception, you know, perception being what seems to be this sort of faux, you know, life, faux, you know, you're putting on a show for others. And so,
and especially when your job, at least when he was coming up, depends a lot on the word of others. You know, this guy knows about Shell Oil in 1984. This guy knows about the airplane thing of whatever. Like, when you rely on the word of other people and you are losing touch with reality because of your addiction and your pain and your high-flying life, the fact that you've been perpetuating fraud for years and getting away with it, it makes you lose your sense of self and what is real in front of you.
It's yeah.
And so enter a new character, Robert Booth Nichols. Have you ever seen King of the Hill?
No, I haven't. But okay. I know it happens in Garland, Texas, and I know that you're obsessed with King of the Hill.
I do love King of the Hill.
Yeah.
There's a character on it named Dale Gribble, who's a conspiracy theorist, and his whole thing is, like, the government is going to let, you know, his conspiracy theories do not line up with real conspiracy theories,
okay.
like, in the world. He's like, you know, it's Big Rat trying to get people to, like, put more poison out.
Yeah. You know, they don't want you to, you
know. And so he meets, Sam Israel III meets a guy named Robert Booth Nichols, who spins this whole story about being an ex-CIA operative who knows about all of the big money in the world, the Rothschilds, the Illuminati, the Bilderberg Group. all of that is happening, and I, Rubber Booth Nichols, used to like stop all of that stuff. And if you send $150 million to London, I will give you some secret bonds that came from China during the like second Cultural Revolution that are worth millions and millions of dollars.
Wow. Right. Okay.
And this is the part where the book really stinks, because the book goes 7-8 chapters explaining all of what Robert Booth Nichols was explaining to Sam Israel.
Okay.
And part of it is like, yes, rich people, like the people, you know, like the Rothschild family or whatever.
Sure.
Like these are very rich people who do have a lot of influence.
And a lot of, yeah, a lot of
I'm
power.
Not saying that that's not, you know, true
no.
or whatever. Or that, you know, things that are sketchy happen behind closed doors.
Sure.
But, like, this sounds ridiculous. The, everything that you're saying and spelling out for us of, like, the, you know, it's also Satan and it's also this. It's just, you sound dumb.
I think he's onto something, actually. I'm going to stand up for the Mr. Nichols and say, yeah, deep state conspiracy. No. but yeah, to also to be like so kind of like close to this world, like it's one thing if you're like completely out of this world mm-hmm. to be like, yes, it is like these amalgamous people. But it sounds like he's pretty like well connected and like what is actually going on. Mm-hmm. So yeah, he's doing the he's being in it and still kind of it's very hypocritical, I think.
Yes. So what is kind of very, very funny is Sam Israel III ran a scam, mm-hmm. functionally, from 1996 to 2003. And the way the scam comes down is he blows all of his money on getting scammed
okay.
by Robert Booth Nichols.
Awesome. That's, you know what? And, like, that's just how life is just poetic, you know? Like, that it all just comes around and goes around.
This is from the book. Bayou's audit for 2004 was released at the end of March. Richmond Fairfield, the fake Dan Marino auditing firm,
yep.
reported that the fund had $410,626,200 under management. The real number was anyone's guess.
Wow.
The loss in terms of actual money was perhaps $75 million. If the accumulated performance was considered part of the lost money, then nearly $250 million was gone. Money that never existed in the first place.
Ugh.
With $100 million in London and $50 million tied up in dubious investments, Bayou was essentially broke. But that didn't stop Marino from wiring $15 million to the Cayman Islands to keep his venture capital plays alive and
yes,
provide getaway money.
I love it when someone wires money to the, either the Cayman
getaway
Islands
car.
Or Switzerland. Yeah, obsessed. Yeah. Gotta get my money out.
So with all the, and again, the book goes into way too much detail about Rubber Booth Nichols and like the circle and the octopus and the global conspiracy about who really controls the money.
Okay.
Sam Israel III starts making dubious investments. The FBI obviously gets word of this
of course.
Because it's so much money that's coming up.
That's an obscene amount of money.
At one point, he was convinced he was going to find like $1 billion worth of gold under the Arizona desert.
Oh, and I wish he did.
And someone who worked at the government was like, my dad's a geologist and I live in Arizona and I just know that isn't true.
That's not, yeah,
you know?
Wow.
So like the government just like gets wind of all of this dubious money getting sent around, so they start investigating Bayou. I mean, like, long story short, because this part is just not interesting to me. Bayou Hedge Fund shuts down on July 27th of 2005 with a crazy ass detached from reality email from Sam Israel about needing to spend more time with his family, with whom he's divorced.
This is not now.
And he's living
he's in, when he, you know,
and he's still living
to...
in the Donald Trump house.
Oh my God.
And he's at points naked watching SpongeBob SquarePants and on the phone with like a trader from Bayou being like, I think things are going bad, dog.
This guy's obsessed with SpongeBob.
No,
which
I'm
honestly
being
awesome.
For real.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to make an even longer story short, because there were news articles coming out at the time, like there were people reporting on this, but nothing particularly interesting happens in the court proceedings other than, I mean, they did it. You know? Like,
yeah, okay.
It's
like,
very
that's,
straightforward.
It's very clear.
They did
you know,
it.
It's a closed casket case.
People
you know?
Are out
yeah.
of a lot of money, which again, it's like high wealth, rich people, but it's also like, you know, maybe the state of Illinois investing its pension funds into this hedge fund. You know,
yeah.
like, that would stink to be out of that money.
Oh my God, of course. It's a lot of people that they're, like, screwing over
exactly.
here.
So they're sincere victims in this situation.
Yes.
It's difficult to get that money back,
yeah, no
et
restitution, yeah.
So on January 30th, 2008, Dan Marino was sentenced to 20 years in prison for his role.
Okay.
In April, Sam Israel was given the same sentence. Okay. The sentences were among the highest ever given to white-collar criminals.
Yeah, 20 years? That's a lot.
And I need to point out, again, this is April of 2008, and the big like climax of the financial crash of 2008 was like September
okay.
of 2008.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, had they gone just a couple more years, they could have like,
maybe skirted by,
yeah.
you know, got away with 9/11, got away with the 2008 financial crash, you know, like...
But yeah, April of 2008, Sam is also sentenced to 20 years. And he's given extra time before he has to go to jail to get his medical affairs in order.
Okay.
Because he really does have that many back problems. He had open heart surgery at some point.
Jeez.
Right. So they give him the extra time to get his medical affairs in order. On Monday, June 9th, 2008, disgraced hedge fund manager Sam Israel drove in the 100-degree heat up to Bear Mountain Bridge in upstate New York. He parked on an overpass and took a deep breath. Jumping would guarantee millions for his disgraced wife and children in life insurance. It would mean an end to the pain, the cycles of addiction. He wrote, "Suicide is painless," in the dust of his windshield, looked up at the cloudless sky, and on Monday, June 9th, he leapt. 2 feet below where a car picked him up as he faked his own suicide.
You're joking.
I'm not joking you.
Oh my God.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
And he goes into hiding.
Okay, this is what it's about. This is what it's about. That's amazing. That's awesome. On the lam. Holy shit.
Sam
said it's painless. Wow.
This
oh
is
God.
From the book. Sam bought the luxury 26-foot Freelander and installed a Tempur-Pedic mattress. Upgrading the sound system cost $4,000. Flat screen televisions, upscale kitchenware, designer linens made the camper homey. Sam bought 2 cell phones, 2 digital voice recorders, a GPS, and an iPod. He loaded with the Allman Brothers.
Hell yeah, brother.
The book, Getting Out, Your Guide to Leaving America, provided detailed planning information for living as an expat, including tips on the best beaches in Central America.
Oh. Holy shit.
He had a collection of pills like fentanyl and stuff that he had his suicide pack ready to go if he got cornered by law.
Wow.
He found the, this is now me, that was, I'm sorry, I was quoting from the book before.
No, yeah.
He found the identity of a man named David Clapp, who died in 2001 and was born roughly the same time he was. So he gets a bunch of papers made to be David Clapp, right? Like, he's ready to go on the fucking lam.
That's incredible. That's incredible.
So he's camping out in Connecticut for a while. He drives just kind of all across the country. Yeah. And at some point, I had forgotten to mention this, he had a mistress going on named Deborah Ryan.
Hot.
Who, literally, hot. And it was well known that she had been with him at the Trump house for a long
for
time,
sure.
That she was, you know, kind of inside a lot of what was going on.
And he's like divorced. He's been like long divorced at this
divorced,
point.
Divorced, but
like,
still like trying.
Still like with his wife.
I don't know.
God
like,
knows. The personal relationship.
It's messy. Yeah.
To. Okay. Yeah. Messy. So, I mean, yeah, to fake your own death is a pretty messy thing. And then to have a mistress on top of it. So.
And week one, he's like, okay, I'm a white collar criminal. I didn't kill anyone.
Yeah.
Like the FBI doesn't want me all that bad. I'm just going to camp out.
Okay.
So week one, makes it by. No one's found him.
Yeah, sure.
Week two, it's national news that he faked his own, because people, they didn't find a body in the river that
oh
he supposedly jumped in.
Like,
they looked the entire, like they didn't find anything.
Like, yeah.
So they figured he's probably on the loose. He had the money, the connections. He could definitely go
figure
somewhere.
Figure this out. I can't believe it.
So, and again, this is not like the Bernie Madoff thing in 2008 hasn't happened yet. So this is national news that this guy is on the fucking run and he's like a disgraced Wall Street trader who perpetuated a scam.
This is also like, this is what, 2012?
No, this
said,
is, I'm still in 2008.
2008, okay, but still, like, they have the technology to, like, find people. Like,
yeah.
You can't just, like, disappear, and, like, you know.
Week three goes by. He is still on the lam. He is, you know, out doing drugs and doing whatever the fuck he's doing.
Sure.
And week four, he reads in a newspaper that Deborah Ryan is going to prison for her role in faking
no.
his suicide. Right.
Oh
so
God.
Then he's faced with a choice. That's his mistress. That's his gal.
Oh.
So instead of turning himself in, he tries to kill himself in the desert.
Like actual. Wow.
Goes out, eats a bunch of pills, does the suicide pack and like pack of pills.
Yes,
is what I mean
yeah.
by pack. And then he wakes up in the middle of the desert just like, well, I had to have lived for a reason.
He's like Rasputin, you know. You can't like not kill him, you know. Like, guy's awesome. My God.
He throws up a bunch in the desert because he just took his suicide pack. And he decides, well, I don't want Deborah Ryan going to prison for like my thing
yeah.
because I planned this outside of
fuck.
Her.
Wow.
So then he goes and he turns himself
no.
in.
Uh huh. All for love.
He was put in jail around September of 2008 with a new added bonus of 2 years for absconding.
He only got 2 years for that?
Two extra years,
so 22 years.
Yeah.
I would think if you... I don't know how the judicial system works in the United States of America. However,
2 years does seem very
it's
low.
Very,
for
pretty,
doing that.
Pretty generous. Yeah, pretty kind of. It's like a slap on the wrist a little bit. I don't know. I also don't believe in incarceration, period. Right. But yeah.
You would just think. Yeah. If we're already believing in incarceration.
Yeah, yeah. If we're in this world, you know, I'm like, 2 years? That's child's play. Yeah. I mean, with the 20, but.
So I'd mentioned, like, he got caught and, like, put in jail in September 2008, which then is when the big climax of the financial crash happens and people find out about Bernie Madoff. So then Sam Israel is just comparatively small potatoes, which is very funny, ironically, I guess. Like, it's still a dizzying $30 million-ish that are just, like, gone.
Sure, disappeared.
But Bernie Madoff was dealing in the billions of dollars, right? Like, that shit was so major. Like, economy changing.
Also, just like drop in the bucket, but also for like the media circus of like what it is. It's so much of a better like news story for someone to be faking their own death and like, you know, like hunting a criminal, you know, than like then the Bernie Madoff story, famously.
Right.
Yeah, that guy was crazy.
In 2008, he's, you know, jailed for 22 years.
Ugh.
And as you know, it is the year of our Lord 2025. And so in 2 years, October 5th of 2027 is when he's eligible to be released.
Wow.
Now, you know, answering the question, where is he now? It's pretty evident that the judge on this case, Colleen McMahon, fucking hates him.
Okay, sure.
He's twice asked for compassionate early release based on his horrifying, ailing health. Yeah. And she's denied it both times and made public comments both times. Like, why the fuck would I treat you any differently, huh?
Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah, sounds like he's a fucking asshole, you know?
A big fuck you. Yeah. Go to jail. You're eligible for release October 5th, 2027.
Yeah, do not
so
pass go. Do not collect $200.
Start that countdown timer.
Yeah.
The final thing I have is he and Bernie Madoff live in the same Butner, North Carolina prison complex.
You're joking.
I'm not joking.
Oh, that's so beautiful. You know,
I hope they find love.
I hope they, you know. Do you think they've ever explored each other's bodies? <those two? laughs>
And that's the story of the Bayou Hedge Fund Group.
Oh, well, wow.
Did you like it?
I had so much fun. I learned a lot today. I learned a lot about numbers, about, honestly, how to not fake your own death.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, yeah, that was... I'm really gonna sit with that. I really have to like stew on that. That's really gonna stick with me, you know.
And thank you for joining. Oh, sorry.
Oh no, but just the performance of money. The performance of money. It does make you. It'll make you miserable, and people just don't know how to live right. You know. People don't know how to live like well. You know, even if they were given the money, like people just like wouldn't know what to do with it. They would spend on stupid things. Like
that's how you know that it's more than like yes, there is obviously an economic sickness in this country, economic inequality, whatever. But even the people who are winning still don't know how to live.
No, it's because they have no taste. You know, I think that's like the terrible part about it is that they just don't have any like sense of what to do with it.
Mm-hmm. And that quote about like you can't show your son a building that you made or whatever.
Yeah, there's nothing tangible, nothing physical. It's all made up. It's all not real.
That certainly, screws with your perception of reality and what is meaningful, what matters.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Oh yeah, awful.
That'll get you.
It will. It really, really will. Yeah, much to ponder on. This was fun.
Really?
This is a great time.
You had a great time.
This
I'm
was
so
a lot
happy.
Of fun. Yeah, I like it here. This is a great time.
And we're
yeah.
never leaving.
No, no.
Lock the
again,
doors.
Once this airs, you can call into the studio. So please, we ask.
So, I mean, that's all I had for you. So if you'd like to add anything as your final thoughts or final plugs or whatever.
Oh, my God. If you want to see what a terrible portrait looks like, just follow me on Instagram at terrible.portraits, and I pop up all around the city.
And on the news.
Come and get a terrible portrait from me and say that you know Christian Borky from BBB. Gonna get a BBL right after this, for sure. this is awesome. This is really fun. I liked this a lot. Thank you for having me. This is an honor, truly.
Thank you for coming on, Jacob. I will see you next time on Busted Business Bureau.
Bye, everybody. Ciao.